He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Nau mai, whakaronga mai, ki te ao tai whenua. Welcome to Country Life, I'm Sally Round.
And I'm Duncan Smith. G'day. Today we head to a North Canterbury vineyard in the thick of harvest.
We have a new series on farmers and growers in the Pacific. Our first guest is from Tonga.
And a small-scale market gardening business is making a comeback. Catch that in about 20 minutes from now.
And later, the thudding of hooves on the sand at Castle Point. The beach races there have been going for nearly 50 years.
Now, though, we're heading to North Canterbury with Cosmo. He's at one of Black Estate's organic vineyards at Ōmihi with Will Bowman.
So we're at the Netherwood Vineyard, one of the three sort of sites that we have. And it's a relatively quiet day because there's been no harvesting today, but there's a red ferment, so from the Damsteep Vineyard, which is sort of 5 km north of us here, that we will be pressing, we'll be basket pressing today. Mm. Yeah.
The view from the winery across this small block of vines is quite spectacular. How would you describe it, Will?
It's a really good representation of North Canterbury, I think. You've got the rolling soft hills, soft geology in the background on a clear day, which you can't quite see today. You have the mountains behind them, and you can see sort of little limestone outcrops around the place too, which is quite a uniquely North Canterbury thing.
Tell me about this particular block.
Yeah, so Netherwood was planted in 1986, so has some good age to it. It's Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. It's all unirrigated, so dry farmed, which is a relatively challenging thing to do in North Canterbury because of the sort of quite low rainfall we have. But if you can do that, you can certainly achieve quite amazing flavours in the grapes and the subsequent wines. It's also own-rooted Pinot Noir, which is scarce these days because of a thing called phylloxera, a little louse that attacks the Vitis vinifera roots. So, most plants are on, most grapes are on American rootstock. But every year it produces really unique flavours, quite concentrated fruit, and, so it's a special site.
How do you deal with insects and diseases organically?
I guess what we're trying to do is sort of cultivate as much life as possible in what is sort of inevitably a monoculture, so producing grapes, but we're not spraying any pesticides or herbicides, insecticides, so kind of wanting to use nature's own energy and systems to aid in the sort of protection or sort of boosting the life of the system as it should be. Yeah.
The vines on the hills in front of us are still under nets. When will they be harvested?
So we're going to harvest here this week. So it's been quite an early season this year. For example, some of this vineyard was still being harvested in early April last year. So, we're going to take these nets off and get the grapes into the winery.
Do you hand pick?
Yes, we do. Yeah. And so whites, for the most part, will be pressed in this big bag press. Some portions of that will get a little foot stomp just to extract a little bit more flavour and texture before being pressed. And the red grapes, again, really simple. We'll just bring them in and a portion will get destemmed depending on the condition of the grapes. Some will stay whole bunch and they'll go into stainless or wooden fermenters and ferment for anywhere between 2 and 4 weeks, and then we'll basket press them. So we've got an old basket press that we use for the red grapes, and then they'll go to the barrel hall and hang out there until bottling.
Excellent. And Will, as well as working for the Black Estate Vineyard, you also have developed your own label that's called Vita Wines.
Yep, totally.
Tell me about that. How did that come about?
So last year, 2020, I was able to buy grapes for the first time, some from here actually, which I've been really lucky to do, from the Netherwood Vineyard. And I mean, I've spent a few years working for some amazing people, so it's been really lovely to now sort of take those experiences and channel them into my own wine. So I've bottled those wines now from 2020 and they're labelled and ready to go. So once harvest is over and the dust has settled, I'll quite excited to release those to the market.
And what sort of wine have you been making?
So I've made a Pinot Noir and a Riesling from 2020, and a pink wine, I'm calling it, for just lack of rosé, I guess. Yeah, a light red, we call it a light red. And, I mean, last year was a pretty amazing vintage. We had a great season and really sort of concentrated, vibrant flavours. So I really just wanted to put that to bottle as like, capture that energy that the season gave us and show that. So yeah, fresh, sort of vibrant, really drinkable, digestible wines. Yeah.
Mm. So where is that wine going to go to?
Well, good question. No, I've got a few sort of bars and restaurants on the radar that I've spoken to, and yeah, certainly locally in Christchurch and Auckland, and I'll do a trip to, you know, Wellington and Auckland and try and sell some more to sort of small, yeah, independent bars and restaurants.
That's the hard thing, isn't it? Getting your wine out there.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally. Yeah, kind of, it's made and in bottle, you think the job is done, but not quite. Mm. Yeah.
What is it about wine that you love? I mean, I'm guessing it's your passion.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a great question. I think it all started off with the flavours of wine, not knowing anything about how they're made. And then I went and studied it and sort of learned a little bit about the science, and that's all well and good. But then, yeah, since working in vineyards and seeing different wines being made, I think there's just a certain magic to the whole transformation that is pretty alluring.
Will Bauman from Black Estates Netherwood. We'll put a link to Will's wines on our website.
Now to our look at conditions on the land. Western Northland's looking for rain, especially parts of the Kaipara district. The East Coast has fared a lot better, and a sheep and beef farmer who'd love rain says Whangarei has had more than its fair share. Northland's had 3 dry summers in a row and 2 fairly dry winters. Feed is of poor quality, and our contact is feeding out a huge amount of silage each day. Fortunately, a lot has been made thanks to a good November. He says he hasn't grown any grass in the past 2 months and has cut his stock numbers by a quarter.
The Pukekohe district has had what it needed, about 70 millimetres of rain. That'll help kiwi fruit size up, but on vegetable paddocks, the odd harvesting machine has been stuck in the mud. It's still very wet and more rain is expected. Growers are turning off irrigation systems. They're expensive to run and maintain. Anything that falls from the sky is free. Waikato has had outstanding rain. Up until Thursday, most areas had had 80 to 100 millimetres. Temperatures have been in the early 20s and you can see the grass growing. Near Tokoroa, rain for March totaled 230 millimetres. An ag economist tells us dairy farmers are going to have an exceptionally good season financially. This rain will put an extra few hundred kilograms of milk solids in the vat, and many will be able to milk right to the end of May.
There wasn't a cloud in the sky when we called Bay of Plenty on Thursday morning, but there'd been thunder and lightning and heavy rain earlier. Kiwi fruit growers are lining up, waiting for their gold fruit to be given the green light for picking. There are reports of the season running 3 to 4 million trays behind so far. Last year it was dry and sunny, and the fruit seemed to mature earlier. Dairy farmers are having a good run. King Country's welcomed 60 to 80 millimetres of rain this week. The ram is out with the ewes, who are on nice fresh grass, which should bode well for good scanning results. Stock prices are good, about $100 for a lamb, down from $120 last year, but those were record-breaking prices. Farmers are weaning calves, pregnancy testing cows, and fixing things they've broken. There have been a few farm listings in King Country, and farmers are fearful people will accept offers from people wanting to put them into forestry.
Taranaki had between 85 and 125 millimetres of welcome rain. It was spread over 4 days with a tiny bit of minor flooding. Milk production's at an average to good March level, but well up on last year when it was very dry. Across the country, and the Gisborne grape grower we rang says they are picking grapes like fury in changeable weather conditions. Yields have been down around the country, but his have held steady. He says he has enough pickers and says they're motivated and energetic, and he's very, very grateful to have them. He's currently picking Syrah, and after Easter will bring in the rest of the Chenin Blanc. He's been talking to a New York importer who is crying out for New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc.
Northern Hawke's Bay is trucking along really well, but much of the rest of the region has had just 4 or 5 millimetres of rain this week, and the soil moisture deficit is similar to this time last year when there was a crippling drought. What's different to last year is there's feed in the barns, silage stacks are full, and farmers can get stock off the farm to be processed. Taihape and Rangitike are also quite dry. And Wairarapa had a big dump of rain overnight on Wednesday, so farmers will be very relieved, especially as it's still warm enough for pasture to have a growth spurt.
And to the south, where about 60 millimetres of rain has held up apple harvesting in the Tasman region. They're about to start the very busy time with mid and late season varieties coming on stream. Jazz has just started. Picking gangs will need to double in number after Easter to cope with the volumes, and growers are hugely worried there won't be enough pickers by a country mile. Kiwi fruit pickers are also needed. The pack houses are starting later because there's less fruit this season after the Boxing Day hailstorm wiped vines out. Marlborough farmers have welcomed the rain on their parched land. It was substantial pretty well everywhere. High country farmers are getting ready for the rams to go out later this month or early May. Grass has been getting short, so the rain will freshen things up nicely if the temperatures stay mild.
A dairy farmer at Franz Josef on the west coast says they've had an amazing run of weather over the past 8 weeks, mild and sunny. Now, this doesn't happen very often, but rain was needed, and it arrived last weekend with an overnight downpour of 80 millimetres. The rain is washing recently applied lime in. With a firmer ground, it's been a piece of cake getting oats and annual ryegrass sown. The cows are in top condition, and the farmer reckons it's because he's gone to once-a-day milking. In mid-Canterbury, the feeling of winter is starting to bite. The morning task of shifting the brake fence is well underway. The other day, our contact clocked up 15 kilometres over 5 hours just to move fences. Otherwise, farmers are catching up on maintenance and a little bit of crutching. They'll be hoping for some downtime over Easter.
When we spoke to our contact in South Otago, he was putting the rams out with the ewes. A second lot of rams will go out in 10 days and they'll stay for a month. The ewes are being fed an extra meal of sheep nuts and baleage to keep up condition for mating. A lack of killing space at meatworks is continuing to cause headaches. Conditions underfoot are quite dry. It's been 5 weeks since the farm had a decent rain. But luckily, the morning dews are helping winter crops get going. Rain this week has been holding up getting the last of the grain off in Southland. Traditionally, the lower South Island is late harvesting barley and wheat, but if the rain carries on, it may get too cold to harvest and the crop will go to waste. Stock are looking good.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Did you know the word kai, meaning food, is understood in many Pacific Island countries? For example, it's kakai in Pidgin, kai in Tongan, and ai in Samoan. Country Life has a new occasional series, Just Kai, where we catch up with farmers and growers in the Pacific to hear how they're faring, what they're growing, and how their businesses are coping. First up, we're calling Tonga.
Hello, my name is Rea Tākai. I live in the beautiful island of Ewa, which is in the Kingdom of Tonga. Married to Kenny, she's a farmer of this family, which brings income to the family. I'm a teacher.
What do you grow mainly?
We grow different type of crops like vanilla, kava, taro, tapioca, as well as the giant taro.
Where do your crops go?
Firstly, goes to our family. Some of them, we sell them out for money. Some of them, we take some of the crops overseas.
I understand that you sell your vanilla to a New Zealand company?
Yeah, it's the Heilala. It's almost 1,000 vanilla plants.
Has it been a good year for growing vanilla?
Yes. Yeah, I'm talking about the money. So comparing vanilla to the other crops, we have more profit on vanilla than the other crops.
How difficult is it to grow?
I think starting of vanilla is a little bit harder, But the benefit at the end of when you get the harvest, you get the benefit from it.
It grows on another plant, doesn't it?
Yeah. It grows on a fiki plant. I'm sorry, I don't know the English name for fiki, but we just call it here in Tonga as fiki plant. So we first clear the land, then we grow the fiki, make sure the fiki is grow, and then you grow the vanilla plant beside the fiki tree. We're coming to the harvesting season. Around May, early June, is when we harvest.
Who does the harvesting?
It's just my husband, Kenny. Kenny's the one doing the harvesting. His majority of the stuff is the one, he's the one doing it, and the pollinating the vanilla, and as well as the harvesting.
Tonga has also been having a lot of restrictions because of the COVID lockdown. Has that had any impact at all on your ability to grow your crops?
I think the problem is it's just the materials that we need when we take care of the vanilla plantation. We need wire to make a fence to protect the vanilla from other animals. I think we need a chainsaw, you know, to cut down the trees. If then cyclone, the vanilla will be safe. No trees will fall down and damage the vanilla. They need like a weed cutter to take the weeds between the rows of the vanilla plant. I think that's the major problems here.
How is the crop looking this year?
I just asked my husband, but because this is our third time harvesting it, he said we'll be expecting more than those previous 2 years before. My husband shared this to me. Growing other crops, it's a hard work to do. But vanilla, at the beginning, it's a little bit harder. But then it's just easy. All you need to do is just pollinate it. Pollinate it as much as you can and just take care of that. And then harvest it, you come and take it to the company, you get your money. And my husband said, oh, to me, I'm getting older. This is the type of crop that I want to grow according to my age and my energy. His focuses on vanilla.
Are there many vanilla growers on Ewa?
No, just a few. That's what my husband is sharing to other growers. He told them, you should grow vanilla.
Vea Takai from Tonga. The plant that grows the vanilla pods or beans is from the orchid family. Vanilla can only grow 10 to 20 degrees north and south of the equator, and apparently it's the second most expensive spice after saffron.
Small-scale market gardening has probably been seen as a sunset industry in recent decades. Larger growers have taken over smaller ones, things have become mechanised. But is the tide turning, and are family-based market gardeners on the comeback? Well, Susan Murray caught up with some growers in Waikato.
These models are everywhere. Like we're copying other people in New Zealand. You know, there's loads of others in New Plymouth and Hamilton has a few. They're around. The locality and the localism of our food is the best part of it. You know, we want to be able to supply our own community before we're putting it on a truck and it's going to Pack and Save or something.
So that's Eddie Robinson, who owns just over 3 hectares of land near Raglan, a seaside town west of Hamilton. And there's Annie Rose, who's there as a woofer with her husband, Nick.
We just decided that life is too precious and there's an unknown future in the wake of climate change, and we want to be resilient and be ready for that, support our family in that, yeah, and that led us to growing. Yes, with that, it's a no-brainer for us,
yes,
really.
There's also Kalani, Havana, and Kylie Robinson living here. So busy life, Kylie.
Yeah.
A 3-year-old and a 4-year-old and a full-time business.
Yeah, and a husband that works part-time still also. Yep, good times though. We'd hate to be bored.
And on Soul Food Farm, I think there's little chance of that.
Soul Food Farm.
Great name.
Yeah, thanks.
Tell me about it.
Eddie came up with that.
Yeah,
we just wanted something kind of sounding really organic and what we were about, and it was, yeah, about soul food and having stuff that was good for your body. And
we just want to give to the community as well, you know, so we sort of thought showing a bit of soul to everyone else in there.
you know, a bit of love to everyone around in the community and stuff would be good. And I don't know, it just seemed to flow well.
When you were growing up, what did you think you were going to be doing as a big person?
Not this. Not this at all. Yeah, I was busy having babies and Eddie was busy kind of going down this rabbit hole of learning about market gardens, and just one day came to me and said, let's start one.
Yeah, because what were your dreams growing up?
I was going to be a rugby player. That was it. I went to university. I was going to be a teacher, but I went overseas playing rugby and did that for a little bit and had a big injury, and that was the end of that. And then it was a whole what do we do now sort of thing, and travelled to Europe and spent a long time living over there and learned to chef and did the chefing thing, super yachts and ski chalets and stuff. And yeah, I've always been quite anchored in food, and yeah, it's an odd thing. It really is an odd thing to be living off the land as such, you know, like I'm not from a farming family either, and to end up now on our own piece of land really having a crack at it, but in a different way.
Yeah.
It's not conventional, it's different, you know, and I think anyone can do it. When we first started growing things, we wanted to be able to grow stuff I served in luxury lodges and stuff. But you don't get that at a supermarket, you know, you have to grow it yourself or pay a lot for it. And so we built a rough greenhouse, and that's how we got the idea, really.
I mean, it was just really, really little scale, eh? So we just kind of grew stuff that we love to eat, but that kind of slowly turned when we did it commercially, because we soon realised that not everybody wants the weird stuff that don't really know what it is, or they kind of want to see the stuff that you see on a supermarket shelf. So yeah.
I have to balance it.
If you want to make money,
yeah,
you've got to
put the chef to one side and sell people what they want. People are getting better at buying seasonally, but it's still easy at a supermarket to get a tomato in the middle of winter. So it's just about changing perceptions and changing attitudes towards seasonality. And we want people to know what you should be eating at a certain time of the year, because you literally cannot grow some things. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. I've come from between chefing and now I've been a commercial dairy farmer. So it's the other end of the spectrum, you know. We couldn't be any further removed from that right now. But we have, because the market garden's a small part of where we see this being. Like, we see it much more as a regenerative small-scale farm. Really diversified. So we have calves here that are just for ourselves, but they're going to be part of a bigger system with pastured hens and with Christmas trees, with the market garden, with the Airbnb. It creates a diversified small-scale farm where you can generate proper income.
Yeah, so, and you do or will be?
Hope to be. Not right
now. We hope so. We're in too deep now to not. Yeah, I mean, we're definitely still in the building phases of the business. That's the dream. We'd really love that this is all our profit to support our family comes from this bit of land.
The larger farms, you know, that just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, doesn't have to be that way. You just take on more debt, you take on more stress, and everything's harder. By going smaller and just having a number of different income streams, you can create a good life. It can be done.
And it's about growing smarter, isn't it? A lot of small-scale market gardens that we follow overseas, a few of them are kind of downsizing.
Each year getting a little bit better, a little bit better, but you don't have to keep that land size the same. Like, a lot of the best market gardeners, especially in the States, are getting smaller every year, but their profits are getting higher because they just get better. I think in New Zealand, especially from conventional ag, the theory has been you've got to go big and you've got to keep getting big. You can see that in dairy all across the country. They're huge, but it doesn't have to be that way.
You've got people helping you, haven't you?
Yes.
A little bit. Where have they run away to?
I think they're watching our kids for us right now. so they're a really cool young couple that have been with us, and they are really interested in doing what we do for themselves one day. Wanted a bit of an internship to, you know, get some hands-on experience. You can go and read as many books as you like, but until you're doing it, you know, and seeing how it works day to day. And
very different.
We were worried it might put them off, seeing how it actually, what it actually takes to run a business.
So you're here learning, are you?
Yes, this is our last stop after a year of woofing, which is working on organic farms.
Yeah, and around New Zealand.
Around New Zealand, all around New Zealand. And yeah, now we're going to start our own thing in Taupo. Wow. Hopefully, one day.
Watch the space.
No, yeah. Not hopefully, we are.
You are. Yeah.
So you'll buy some land or you have some land there? Or
We don't have any land. And we're hoping one day that we'll buy land, but we'll probably have to lease, yeah, to begin with.
So if anyone's got land in Taupo...
Oh, yeah, if anyone has...
contact Danny Rose at now.
Half an acre to an acre of flat land in Taupo with all-day sun.
I just say, it is a bit colder
and
there.
And water supply. Yeah.
And water. Find me on Facebook.
Because that will be quite a challenge, won't it? Growing what crops... you know, there'll be a huge difference, won't there, temperature-wise?
There is a huge difference. We have a lot more frost than the coastal areas, but we'll just need infrastructure straight away.
Yeah, so lots of tunnels and stuff come into play. You'll need that we have.
Bigger startup cost maybe than if you were by the coast. But that's all right. It'll all be worth it because no one's growing there. And
the two of you aim to do that?
We do, yeah. Small scale, but still produce a lot.
And a wide range of different crops.
Yep.
And were you always keen to do this as a job? Like, what's your background?
I studied fashion up in Auckland, and then I met my husband, and we were both managing retail and hospitality outlets. And then we just decided that life is too precious and, you know, there's an unknown future in the wake of climate change and we want to be resilient and be ready for that and also support our family in that. So, yeah, and that led us to growing. We thought it's a no-brainer for us, really. Yeah.
And are you from any rural background at all?
Not at all, no. Not at all. This is all new to me. But, no, we both, like, as the older we get, that we realise what's really important in life and that's family and food, yeah. So,
and how old are you?
I'm 24.
And your husband is?
28, I think, or 29. Something like that. I think, I'm 25.
You're
25. No, I'm 25.
You had your birthday here not
long
ago.
I'm 25 and he's 28. Yeah. It's a generational thing, the way I think that, like, it's known as a job in my generation now. So I think maybe, like, all the market gardeners I know of are kind of your age and older.
Yeah.
But now there's, like, a new wave coming.
There is.
And they're all young like us, you mean?
Ten years older.
Yeah. But I mean, I think too, like, you know, I look back at my school peers and not a lot of us were kind of, you know, aware of much, you know, to do with the environment and all that kind of thing. And I think just in the last generation it's really changed and people are getting, you know, passionate and, you know, school leavers are, you know, way more educated on things like that than we ever would be. So I think it's cool to kind of see it coming through younger and younger and people getting passionate about growing earlier. Slowly it's kind of coming back to the idea of, you know, what our grandparents were doing.
It's not that different what we do to what they did. It's just a few tweaks here and there. It's a little bigger. But the idea is the freshest stuff every day. And, you know, the freshest stuff you can get. And I think we've missed a few generations of supermarkets and how it's all gone. And that's fine, but I just think it's rotating back around, you know, like everyone wants their stuff quick and they want it fresh. And that's what this market gardening movement's all about, is freshness. It's the one thing that they can never take from you in a supermarket. They can never compete. The supply chain just won't let that happen. It's as simple as that.
And people want to know where their food comes from more as well.
As a younger voice, you know, the 25-year-old, is this all true that you're seeing that with your friends?
There is a knowledge there, but it's definitely... You definitely have to be in the circle, I think. But Instagram played a big role in us for finding out what market gardening is. And, like, we found these guys through Facebook and Instagram. So, yeah, social media must have a big role to play, I think.
So when can we visit you in Taupo and see that you've got your market garden up and running?
There you go. Put a date on it.
Oh. We'll be totally up and running and producing in 2 years.
There you go.
Yeah.
And do people pay more for your product?
Yep. Yeah, we're definitely a higher price point than the supermarket. We also use home compostable packaging, which costs us a lot more than your regular plastic bag. So those little things that, you know, there's quite high costs in some of the things that we do.
And how big was the move then to go from growing what you liked growing for yourselves on lease land to what? Do you own this plot here?
Yeah. We do own this, and just the succession of it all. You can't miss weeks now. Like, whereas before we were smaller scale and sometimes we had things, sometimes we didn't. Now that's not really cutting it. We have to have it every week and we've got to be consistent or else people will get it from a supermarket. And we're trying to be that supermarket so that people can get from us every week the freshest produce you can get. You know, we harvest the day before and they're getting it the next day.
You're never going to get that in a supermarket, I don't care where you live.
We're still learning along
half
the way.
Half the stuff we grow now, I'm growing it for the first time. I've never grown it before. There's stuff right in the garden now that I've never grown before.
Let's have a look.
Oop. There's actually right here. We've just put the greenhouse on top of Wawa cabbage, which is like Asian cabbage. And it's cabbages and bok choys I've never grown before, ever, this first lot. And we're selling it as we're growing it and trying to figure it all out at the same time.
But we like to wing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds quite daunting, actually.
Yeah, it's a little bit. You try not to think too hard about it or you'll get too nervous.
No, we're in it for the long haul now.
How do you ever get away?
We don't.
We don't.
No, we actually just had our first 4 days away in 3 years and it was amazing. But, I mean, when we jumped into it, we knew it was going to be, you know, we weren't going to get a trip away and our summer holidays are kind of no longer. Yeah, I mean, we live in paradise, right? So
yeah, I'm a little biased. I surf, I fish, you know, and living here means that I can do those things even when I'm still working.
Yeah.
So it's a good trade-off.
Kylie and Eddie Robinson from Soul Food. And you also heard from Annie Rose Gibson.
Kia ora whānau, I'm Nadine Toitoi, one of the owners and directors of Kohutapu Lodge and Tribal Tours out in Murupara. You are listening to Country Life on RNZ National.
We're heading to Wairarapa now, where last month, thoroughbreds, station hacks and ponies were saddled up for the annual horse races at Castle Point Beach. The races started back in 1872, and apart from wartime and stormy years when the beach was too rocky, they've been held every year since, marking the end of summer at this small coastal community. I went along to capture a slice of the atmosphere. We're heading to Wairarapa now, where last month, thoroughbreds, station hacks and ponies were saddled up for the annual horse races at Castle Point Beach. The races started back in 1872, and apart from wartime and stormy years when the beach was too rocky, they've been held every year since, marking the end of summer at this small coastal community. I went along to capture a slice of the atmosphere.
How's the sand looking today?
Oh, it's excellent. No, this is one of the better beaches we get here.
This is Scott Whitehead, local farmer and president of the Castle Point Racing Club.
You do have problems with rocks occasionally,
yes,
don't you?
Yes,
it has been cancelled because of that.
And this is our third year in a row, but say 4 years ago we didn't race because of rocks. Yeah.
Yeah, the horses all arriving. Have you got a big field this year?
It's not records, but it's strong. Like, I think, you know, sort of 10 or 11 horses in most races, so that's fair, and yeah, it's enough. You don't want too many down there logistically at the start and what have you, so.
Keeping order on the track is the job of another local farmer, Charles White.
So you're dressed very smartly, you've got your white breeches on, you're very shiny riding boots.
Yep, yes.
And you've got a stock at the neck,
yes,
neatly tied, and your green corduroy cap on.
Oh, that's the racing club. And that's, I'm a steward there, yeah.
Generations of the same families have been involved in these races, which will turn 150 in a couple of years. Scott's father, Brian, once had the president's job, and Charles took over from his dad 15 years ago.
So I'm clerk of the course.
And what does that involve?
So that involves taking the horses from the marshalling area down onto the beach, and once they are on the beach, there's a little bit of a birdcage in front of the crowd, and then they're sent up to the start line. And during the race, I'm in charge of the beach, essentially, so we're in charge of crowd control. And then if there's a mishap with a horse or whatever, we have to deal with it. So I have myself and two outriders.
What are you looking out for on the course?
So a big thing is crowd control. People don't realise that the race starts way down the end of the beach, and they can quite often wander out to the sea. There's occasionally there's been the odd loose dog and that sort of thing, which is a big hazard. And then some jockeys might need a hand to take a horse, lead a horse down to the start line. You know, a horse has gone out into the surf before. We've had to pull that back in. Occasionally a jockey gets bucked off or something, and we have to you know, make sure that the horse doesn't run into the crowd and that sort of thing.
Are the safety concerns any more than on a normal racetrack?
Well, a normal racetrack, you have the rails. So we do have the crowd, but the, you know, with new OSH rules, we've got barriers and things now, and we have the seawall anyway, so that's not a problem. Yeah.
Well, are you looking forward to the day?
Love it. Every year, yeah. No, it's good fun. It's a great committee to work with, and we're really well supported by trainers, and it's basically an iconic event, so it's probably almost a privilege to be involved, really. So in 2 years' time, we're celebrating 150th celebration, which for a little club, well, a little racing club, is not a bad milestone, is it?
It's time for the briefing in the nearby wool shed belonging to Castle Point Station.
Especially welcome to all those who came last year.
Fortunate timing means COVID didn't stop the event going ahead both this year and last. Listening in are the jockeys, trainers and helpers from the Castle Point community. It's the pony race first, then a race for station hacks. The beach races are not just for the amateurs, though. Well-known trainer Kevin Myers is a big supporter and has several horses racing today.
I bring the horses down because it's more for the younger generation, the kids see what happens, because when we were young we had all this as kids, and if we don't keep doing it, a lot of parents get a bit lazy and don't want to take the kids out on the weekend, but when there's something like this on, they all seem to turn up, and it encourages other kids to get keen in horse sports and everything like that.
You've been coming for a few years now?
I have been coming for a few years. I've probably been coming longer than this lady next door to me.
20-something years.
20-something years.
So, yeah. I think I was 16 when I first rode here.
And how are conditions looking today?
Yeah, good. No, good today. So there's a lot of stronger horses in today, so it's good for the club, and if we can keep it going and get younger ones in. I think five of the people that have worked for me and are training now have bought their own horses this year, so which is good, and I hope we can keep it going for another 50 years.
Oh, isn't this New Zealand at its best?
That's Olympic medal-winning equestrian Tinks Pottinger.
I mean, long live the tradition of something like Castle Point Beach Races, because as you'll see with the number of people here today, it's obviously something that people love. It's sadly, the sun's not out for the most glorious picnic day, but people will come along in their hundreds and absolutely love watching these horses race along the beach right in front of them, so close to them, it's so exciting.
Is there anything else like it in New Zealand?
Well, I'm not sure whether any other places have beach races anymore. I know other parts of New Zealand used to, but this has survived, and it is a really good grounding for a lot of these younger thoroughbreds before they do start their shot at having races. But there's also a lot of experienced horses here as well. But I mean, it's beautiful ground, obviously. But it's great fun. I mean, all I would suggest to anyone who wants to ever try those, make sure you're at the front, because otherwise you get a lot of sand in your face and in your eyes, and sometimes it's very hard to see.
Tents are open for our first race, which will be starting very soon once we have everything underway and everyone in place.
The crowds gather on the beach, and some have arrived in style.
What do you call those? A fascinator.
A fascinator, yeah. It's top quality made from real feathers.
Have you dressed up especially for this?
Absolutely. Yeah, we love a good race day.
Do you come often here to Castle Point?
This is the first time. Yeah, this is the first time, and it will definitely not be the last.
And where have you come from?
We've come from Hawke's Bay. Yep, loving it.
Have you been betting today?
No, we're just about to, actually. Yeah, just about to go and put some money on. Yeah. Number 11. Legs 11.
Just put your bet on.
Oh, yes, I have. I don't know if I'm going to get those, so hopefully five will get
it's
us at least a winner.
Time. We don't understand how this works.
I know, right?
We got told to dress up.
Yeah, but it's a bit cold, so a few layers on.
You've even got a flower in your lapel.
I know. Yeah. I'm lucky that there are some nice pickings on the way here. So,
anything like this from where you're from?
It's a bit more, I think, official with a racetrack and stuff where I'm from in Texas. But I like the local feel here with the beach and everything. So.
Yeah, I think this is awesome. Yeah. Great way to spend the day out. It is a bit chilly.
Yeah,
and what number have you got?
Oh, well, we don't know the number yet. So we have
F
and H. And then I guess they assign numbers to letters randomly, and then you just have to hope for the best.
I mean, you just have to listen to your letter after the race has happened and hope that that's what you've got.
Yeah,
that's
what
we are going for.
Hi, can I have 5 tickets, please?
Back at the busy woolshed, we catch up with one of the professional jockeys, Sean Fannin. He thinks it's his 6th or 7th year at Castle Point.
I ride my job as a jumps jockey for Kevin Myers, and he brings a big team every year, and it's always exciting to get out here.
And what's different about riding on the beach?
It's probably the whole atmosphere, really. I mean, you're in a big straight line, and the sea is crashing in beside you, and more importantly, probably the crowd here. I mean, you don't get a crowd up so close and personal like they do here, and all the locals. I mean, there's quite a big atmosphere, really.
What does that add to the race? Does it add a little bit of risk as well? Or?
Oh, I suppose the horses get hyped up a little bit. You know, they can, just like us, they can feel the atmosphere, and it's quite exciting hearing everyone there cheering for it. I mean, they're here for the thrill of seeing us, the horses race, and I mean, it's exciting for us too, hearing everyone cheer you on, so no, it is exciting.
What about having the sea on the other side? How does that affect the horses?
I mean, they're obviously looking at it. I mean, a lot of these horses have never seen the beach before, so it is something different to them, but I mean, it does add a whole other aspect. They're probably running away from a little bit, but by the time you've shown them the winning post before we can it down to the start, they're going to get used to it pretty quickly, and it is a different aspect though.
And what about the team of horses you have here today? Are they some of the best?
Yeah, we have got some very good horses here today. Zentangle is one. He's won 17 races. I mean, we've got a handful of horses that have won, you know, 6-7 races, anywhere up over, you know, prize money of $100,000-$200,000. So there are some high-quality horses here today.
Tell me, what's it like racing on the sand?
It's quite quick, especially with the where the water is just come over that right in on the tide there. It is the ground is quite firm, so I mean we are going quite fast. So no, it is quite fast out there.
Because you'd think you'd sink a little bit, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I suppose if you where the water is crashing and just right in on the tide there, it does it is very firm right in there. Yeah.
And are you all jostling for that perfect spot?
I guess so. Everyone is trying to be the first one out of the box. I mean, got a bit of an advantage where you can walk up to the start compared to race day when we're locked in the barriers together. We are competitive. Everyone's trying to win, so you are trying to get out there first and get on the inside.
So even though it's a country meet, so to speak, it's still as competitive as out there at a big race day?
Yeah, it's like anything really. I mean, you're all friends off the track, but out there, everyone's out there to have a bit of fun, and there's no more fun than winning.
What race are you in today and who are you riding?
I think I'm going to ride nearly every race. I think I'm on one called Class Above in the Castle Point Cup, and I think it should be a pretty good chance.
Good luck.
Thank you.
The woolshed's still busy. Jockeys with their silks and saddles are here weighing in. Those scales look interesting. Are they antique?
No, they're just our sheep weighing scales.
Farmer Alan Schofield is clerk of the scales.
We've got to weigh the jockeys and make sure that all the horses are ready to go before we can radio through to open a tote. And that needs to be open. That's got to be open for a certain length of time so they can sell the tickets before we can sort of let the horses go and start racing. Because then we've got to close the tote. So it's the whole thing's got to be knitted in. Some years we're pushed for time because the tide's coming in quicker than we want it, so we have to try and condense the race up a bit.
Gosh, that must be a bit of a challenge.
It is. Some years it's quite... This year there's no pressure on us, really.
The tides are looking good, are they?
The tides, yeah, and because we've got a lot of sand on the beach, it means that the tide's going out further, so we've got more beach to work with and more time to run the races. Normally, it's not low tide for another hour yet.
And
we're starting to weigh for the cup, which we normally run at low tide.
What does it mean to the community here, these races?
The community love them. They get to catch up with a lot of their friends and families. And a lot of us are not, we're not really interested in horse racing as such. We love the Castle Point races, but I don't ever go to a race meeting anywhere else. Doesn't appeal to me, horse racing, but I like
doing this, just to be with these people.
There are dozens of volunteers, including Emma Gardner, who's responsible for getting the horses from the woolshed down to the beach. She says the races have been going so long, they work like clockwork.
So there's a lot of history with family. So Brian's son, Scotty, is our president. So we've got generations coming down. We've also got the Balfours. This is like third generation boys that are coming along now that are helping on race day. So it's got a lot of history. And it's just, it's mainly because it's got that history that you feel kind of really important about organising it. In the last few years, there's only been two or three women that have come on board. So it's always been a bit of a man's club. And so I like to add the aspect of having some women on board. So we're kind of making new traditions with it being just a little bit more diverse in the way that it's not just a man's club. Yeah.
Speaking of diverse, they've just run the ladies' race and the jockeys yes. have come in. I'm just going to go and check out and see who won and
good on
talk
you.
To the girls.
Yeah. Thank you.
How'd you go?
Third.
How are you feeling about that?
Good. That was my first one. I've done about three races before this one.
This is 18-year-old local apprentice jockey Vania Mason. Like many of the jockeys, she's racing several times today, so there's no time to waste in between each one.
Can we wait out for the next one? Don't muck around. You're puffy.
Excitement mounts for the main race of the day, the Castle Point Cup. Raced, as Alan said, when the tide is at its lowest. But it's not all about the horses. There are kids' races and fashion on the beach.
Hands up if you need a spoon.
Egan spoon race.
But you've got a golf ball in your spoon.
So it's a golf ball and spoon race.
We've done this like a whole bunch. Yeah, because my dad works in the tote up there.
Have you won before?
Quite a few times.
What are your tactics?
Just try and keep it stable and run fast.
Second prize to Jason in his knitted pants made by his mother. Well done.
It's old-fashioned crochet, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Squares, in fact.
It is. We've got a 1970s caravan, so it's in tone with that. So we've got some crochet blankets that go with it, so yeah.
And look, you've even got a matching tie.
I have, yep. Made especially for today. Again, in the orange and brown, so the good old 70s colours. So, yeah, no, it looks good.
Righto, we'll start that again. Number one, Peso.
Time for the Castle Point Cup.
Number two, Entangle. A for Aaron. Number three, Duplicity. J for Jan. Number four, quite a lot further along the beach.
People line the sea wall for the race, and some, like this family, have been coming regularly for about three decades.
Just a family tradition kind of thing. So most years we come down, yep.
This is your family?
Yes, this is my family, yes, and we've got a caravan that's been here as long as that. One son's got a house here as well, and we just come each year, whoever can come. We always went for holidays here anyway when the children were growing up, so it's just, and now there's grandchildren and great-grandchildren who come as well.
You've got a great perch here on the finish line.
We have, yes, but we do get up about 4:45 too.
And the race is about to start, the cup. Have you got a bet on here?
Yep.
Have they called it yet?
No, they haven't. No, as yet.
Go away, bro. I can't see them, but I think Body on the outside. Go away, bro. He's charging at him. Lady Miner just about got him, I think. Go away, bro. It's Body. Maybe go away, bro. I think on the inside that's beaten Body. Third, maybe Dulong Lampson. Pacer
awesome.
Got home nicely. He's one to watch for the winter. And the winner. Go away, bro. Second, number five, Body. And third, Duplicity, number three. Those numbers, 6, 5, 3, 8, and 1. So the ball team upsets the Myers.
Another cup run and another race day for one old-timer on the sideline, former trainer Don Fuge. He's been coming to Castle Point for 40 years.
years ago, you know, most of the horses would be out here for the week before the races and working on the beach for a week, but now most of them just come on the day now. The horses enjoy the beach, they get used to it. And they always seem to do well after you go home again, yeah. The seawater's good for their legs and that, yeah.
Well, you've got a pretty perfect day today, would you say? Would you say this is one out of the box?
Yeah. Nobody will be getting sunburned today.
Nobody will be getting blown away either. No sand in the horse's face today.
No, it's real good.
Don Fuge on the beach at Castle Point in Wairarapa. There's a video of the races on our website and Facebook page, shot by video journalist Dom Thomas. Do take a look.
Yes, well, that's it for this week. Do check out our webpage. It's got photos and more stories. And remember, you can subscribe to our podcast there too. Have a jolly fine Easter weekend.
Bye now.